Are you ready? Are you sure you're ready? This is a message I'm not sure you're ready for. So I want to make sure you're ready. Experience and logic and the Bible tell me and tell you that you are exquisite. You are extraordinary. You are awesome. You are incredible. You are wonderful. There's nothing like you. No one can be who you are, and no one can do what you do. I know some of you have had a week whereby it's hard to absorb that, but it's true. You are made in the image of God. David writes in Psalm 8 and Psalm 139 that you are fearfully and wonderfully made. He writes that you have been made a little lower than the angels. And get this. Jesus came as you, as a human being. And Paul, after Jesus came, writes this. You will judge angels. You see, you've got a promotion. You're incredible. I know compared to each other, which we do all the time, you maybe don't think much of yourself. And really, when we deal with this truth all the time, that we are awesome and wonderful, I know sometimes you've heard it in grade 2 or 3, and you try to absorb this truth, but the Bible says it's true. The Bible says when God made human beings, he said it was very good. But because we are so profoundly made, because you are so exquisite and extraordinary and wonderful and awesome, you get caught up in your own sin. And so vanity becomes an issue for us. Self-confidence, excessive self-confidence. Self-sufficiency, self-righteousness are all problems. We look at each other and we look down on each other at times because we don't understand how incredibly we're made. And we get sinful. In fact, in the book of Job, one of his friends reflects and says this, God is so graceful and gentle to us that if he was to withdraw his spirit one day because we weren't living up to his image, if he was to withdraw that image of God, the spirit of God in you, if he just pulled it away from you, Job says all humanity would perish together and become dust. I was thinking about it this week, and in my deep spiritual reflection and my rumination and in my studies at Tyndale, I have a solution for God. I want to tell you what it is. This is my solution for God. I think him being graceful and gentle to us is really good. But I don't think that we as humans really give him all the honor and respect. Because there are some very intelligent people that say God doesn't exist, and they're using the very image of God in them to say that. So here's my solution. Here's my solution. I don't know whether God's going to take this, but I think that when we get to the end point of which we have used up the image of God in us, when we're no longer bearing that image, God should instantaneously change us to the animal, the national animal of the country that we're in. I see you as beavers, some of you. No, just kidding. Just imagine, though, if you're in the country of Turkey or Antarctica. Imagine it. If you got to the point where you were no longer living as a human being as God made you, if you were just, bam, an eagle, a beaver, a kiwi bird, kangaroo. Now, of course, I'm speaking in jest, but all of us live in this reality that we have God's image upon us, in our minds, in our emotions, in our social interaction with other people, in our bodies, and in our souls, and we have it every day. And we live with it, and we treat it like common. But it is so beautiful that our walls around us do not make us a church. Our ceiling, what's on the screen, it's your beauty that makes this a church. Speaking with one of our members, about how great churches around the world, when you go into them, are beautiful historical buildings. And when you're in them all alone, there's something in your heart that says, this isn't the church. It's just a beautiful building. We're the people. You are the church. It's not the walls around us. It's you. This is our second week in what I've called concentric care counseling. It's been a challenge for me because it's a foray into something that I'm not very familiar with. But we're looking at the five wisdom books in the Bible. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. These wisdom books in the Bible, it's one of my favorite sections in the Bible. My favorite book is Ecclesiastes. I encourage you to read it. Wisdom section of the Bible, we're looking at these five books. And I need your help. And you need mine. And we need each other's. And as we look at this concentric care counseling, I wanted to use a bullseye. Why a bullseye? Well, I wanted to use a bullseye for this, these reflections, because you and I are both the focus of God's love. We're the focus of God's love. It's where He directs His love. We're also the locus of God's love. Meaning that we are the assembly point. We're the base. We're the ground zero from which love is expressed. We are both the focus and the locus. You are both the target and the launching point at the same time. Your health is vital in God's wisdom because His grace and His truth and His love flows through you to all the people around that you know, and vice versa. You're the locus. A healthy you demands a healthy community. I mean, it demands a healthy church. It demands healthy friends. It demands around you a healthy community because you are not living alone. You're influenced. We don't live in isolation. We, of course, live across all these spectrums in various ways. It's hard. This is a fluid divisions here, if you will. We can have family members that are friends of ours. We can go to church and have people that are there that we're related to or that are professional counselors or that are friends. It's very fluid. It's hard to define. We as humans are so complex. How do you really define relationships? These are all generalities. But we wanted to take these four areas, which are particular in terms of a healthy community, and look at them. And what does God say about them? How do we understand when we think of love coming into us and through us? How do we, from a counsel or an advice point of view, which we'll get to the focus of that, how do we extend that blessing of God's love to our family members? How do we extend it to friends? How do we extend it amongst our church? And how do we understand it and appreciate it and express it, provide for people with professional counseling that blesses us? So, in our community, in this church community, there are 150 counselors. Because all of you are counselors. Every person. As soon as a person can express something to another, at the youngest ages that have just left us, you're counseling each other, good or bad. We see that across the different communities that we have here, the smaller groups of our Bible study, Triple L, Men's Breakfast, Young at Heart, our kids groups, Stomps, even our deacon care model is focused towards providing advice and counsel and loving each other. And of course, we have professional counselors in our community as well, too. Denise Handy is a professional counselor. Don Hepburn has counseled professionally. Nancy Hudden is a chaplain. And Pat Ewell is a professional counselor, as well as Mal Findlay, and others I'm probably not as familiar with. But we live across these spectrums. It's healthy for us to do so. At the end of our talk today, I'll ask you for any reflections you have. So if you have reflections as we go along and you want to write them down, I'll open it up for you to reflect on that as we speak. Because it's not me sharing truth with you that will make this work. It's you living your lives out together and loving each other and counseling each other in particular. So let's first look at family. Family is a fascinating area of counsel. and certainly not something that over 35 minutes or 30 or 20 minutes I could fully address. So this is just an introduction. But let's talk about family. And we're going to pursue this understanding of family in an oft-unused book of the Bible. We're going to look at family in a book that may cause you to blush. In fact, if you read it from start to finish, you will be blushing. If you read it to your spouse from start to finish, you'll be blushing. We're going to look at the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. It's the fifth book of the wisdom literature, and it's a fascinating book. In this book, there's three people in conversation, or three groups in conversation. The lover, the beloved. Solomon is the lover. His fiance is the beloved, and the friends. If you can imagine this conversation that goes on in the Song of Songs, it's the week before their wedding. Excitement's building. And as they plan for their wedding, they have conversations that go back and forth as they love each other. It's fitting after one day after Valentine's Day that we look at the Song of Songs. And so we're going to take a look at this, and so that you don't feel embarrassed, I'll read it for you. We're going to look at chapter 7. If you have your Bibles with you and you want to go to chapter 7 of the Song of Psalms, I'm starting mid-conversation. It's the least embarrassing text that I could read for you. Song of Songs, chapter 7. First of all, let me just say this. The lover has just talked about wine. And wine throughout the Song of Psalms is, by analogy, connected to his beloved. So he's just said the wine is like her lips. So she starts off talking about wine. I had to kind of put that in context. Let me read this for you. May the wine go straight to my beloved, flowing gently over teeth and lips. I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let's go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, if the pomegranates are in bloom. And there I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I've stored up for you, my beloved. It's mid-conversation. You may feel this is a private love letter between two people. Very intimate. Yes, it is. Theologians, as they've studied this book, have tried to produce an analogy between mankind and God. It's hard to make that fit. This is a love note. And so without reliving or without getting into the intimacy of this, there is a few things that we can make and understand in this text about proper counsel in families. Let me just draw your attention to a few. But let me say this first. I believe the most potent counsel that is given across all of ourselves, our emotional, physical, spiritual, our intellectual, comes from family members. I don't know whether our counselors with us would agree, but certainly the intensity of love as God has designed is often expressed in our relationship with our family members. There's an intimacy there that's like no other. And at the heart of the family is romantic eros love. It's the Valentine's Day love that's expressed here. It's eros love, and it is also mixed with philia. Philia is brotherhood love, sisterhood love. It's the love that binds a family together, romantic love and brotherly love. As we consider this text, incoming love that comes to you, an outgoing love that goes from you, has a dynamic that is rich. It's intense. God intends that we belong to someone and they belong to us, and that our desire is for them. And whether you're married or not, in family, people that you are biologically or proximity or familially connected to, the people who you'd call your family, these people have a bond with you that is unique. And counsel and advice and guidance and direction to or from family members, those you're related to, therefore demands great effort. Think about it. The advice that you receive and the advice that you give to those that are closest to you, do you not want it to be the best advice possible? Of course we do. And yet when we live it out in the world around us, it's pretty messy. And we give advice all the time. Good advice and bad advice. In family, would we not want to give the best advice possible? In fact, God's design is family. We can't deny that when we look at the biology and the creation of the family, that God's design is family. I've seen churches in which sometimes the expression is, we as the church surpass family values and therefore need to tell families what to do. The family came first in the Bible. Then the church came. I see no possible way that the church could supplant the family and be effective at it. It's God's design, the family is. Even in its all the way it changes through birth and through marriage, through death, through geography. Jan and I, before we moved to Toronto, were very close to my family, who all live in Lambton County. And we moved here to Toronto, and I made the mistake one day of saying, when I first graduated, but I want to go and move closer to family. And it was like God said, Ken, you are close to family. Janet's family. And I love the opportunity I've had to be able to be connected to Janet's family after we spent 13 years close to my family. It's fascinating how this changes, but belonging starts at home. How we extend that is very important. You have both the need and the capacity. As a human being, you are given this desire to have familiar closeness, people that are close to you, the loveliest family members in proximity in your home, people that you're spent time with, you're related to, biology. You are designed for that. You're designed to be connected to them. And regardless of how we interact across all these spectrums that I talked about, regardless of how this all happens, family is significant. So let me ask you this question. How godly is your advice that you receive and that you give to family members? Have you told someone in your family to do something that's against the Word of God? Have you told someone in your family to do something that was destructive for them? That's bad advice. It's intense. We all have done it. We've all done it. Let me move on, though. Number two, as we exchange love, counsel, and experience in this deepest relationship, we actually grow in our ability to counsel. Come on, those of you that are now grandparents, you're far more experienced in giving and receiving counsel. And I'm amazed when I listen to your stories because you've lived lots of the things that those of us that are younger have not yet. We're wise to listen to you because you've lived it. And as even though we think that we're in a modern age, it still repeats itself. That's the wisdom that God gives. It's been said before that as we garner this advice and this experience and this great ability to exchange love, as this happens, I've heard it said before, the best thing a father can do for his kids is to love their mother. The best thing for a mother to do for her kids is to love their father. Why would I say that? Well, it's because as we grow in experience, God has designed a family, and this eros love that's at the center point of this Song of Songs is very important. I know it's worked out in many different ways, but family love from the very center point of a couple leads and impacts all other spheres. But let's move on. Let's move on to friends. Because as we look at this spectrum, family is certainly something that we, what's the old line? Family ties are the bonds that both bind you and gag you at the same time. Family's hard. Hard for different reasons. But it's also impactful and significant in your life. But let's look at friends. We look at friendship in the Bible. Friend love is called philia. And philia was the friendship sort of love that two brothers would have, friends of each other. It's also storge. Storge was respectful love. Our guys from Stomp here on Friday nights will know this because that's what we looked at on Friday night. These forms of love. Storge and philia. And the Bible's longest discussion is between five friends. The longest discussion in the Bible between five friends as they love each other is found in the book of Job. And in the book of Job, Job has had incredible tragedies in his life. And his four friends gather around him, his four friends named Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu, and they discuss life, and they discuss Job's pain and justice and how it all comes together and God's relationship. And in the end, God answers, and he summarizes, and Job's friend Elihu is the one that's the wisest. So, for six of the chapters in the Bible, Elihu speaks. And he speaks to Job about his relationship with God, about Job's relationship with God. 2,500 words Elihu talks about Job's relationship with God as his friend. Fascinating read. Incredible counsel. And he positions Job's rightful relationship with God. He counsels Job more than any other person in the Bible. And so I've just taken this part of Job's speech to Job. And if you will, please, let's read this together. Job 33, starting at 14. God does speak, now in one way, now another, though no one perceives it, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on people as they slumber in their beds. He may speak in their ears and terrify them with warnings to turn them from wrongdoing, to keep them from pride, to preserve them from the pit, their lives from perishing by the sword. Yet if there is an angel at their side, a messenger, one out of 1,000, sent to tell them how to be upright, and he is gracious to that person, and says to God, spare them from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom for them. Let their flesh be renewed like a child's. Let them be restored as in the days of their youth. Then that person can pray to God and find favor with him. They will see God's face and shout for joy. He will restore them to full well-being. Elihu's counsel here to his friend Job is rich. It's prophetic. It is a blessing to us that this has been saved for thousands of years that we can read in poetic form. It's truly incredible what Elihu says to Job. What he says to Job is something very interesting, and that is, God does speak to us. He speaks to us. And Elihu is in the context of when God spoke through angels and messengers directly to people. That's our distance from Elihu. But he does say God speaks to people. How does he speak to people? He speaks through visions, times in which you can't sleep at night, warnings. Why does he do this? He tells us to turn us from wrongdoing. This is God's counsel. God is counseling us for the betterment of our lives. Why does God speak in our ears? To keep us from pride, to preserve us from going from the pit, from perishing. God desires to counsel us. He is the chief counselor. But there's something else going on here that's profound, because who's speaking this? Elihu is. How is God counseling Job? Through Elihu. What is the most profound way that God counsels you? Through other people. If you tried to measure all the counsel you've received in your life, how could you put it all in a book? Did you ever think maybe God was behind the counsel that you've been receiving? Good counsel when you've received it from people around you. It's profound. This is God's activity. Good counsel is God's intent. God speaks. The profoundness of that is that God does not force us. He doesn't move us. He doesn't zap us into beavers. God speaks to us. He counsels us through other people and through His Word. Good counsel is God's intent. A godly friend is His instrument. How many godly friends do you have? Is the counsel that you give other people that are your friends, is it godly? If it is, you're extending God's blessing through your person to them. And if you receive God's blessing to you and say, I'm not sharing that, I'm going to hold on to that, I'm going to tell everybody else something else to do, then you're building up inside of you all of God's good blessing, and it's going to burst. Let it flow through you. Good counsel is God's intent. A godly friend is His instrument. But something else is going on as Elihu continues. Because Elihu says, furthermore, there is a messenger. And the messenger is sent to tell people how to be upright. Good counsel. This messenger can say to God, keep this person from going to hell. A messenger says, I found a ransom for them. I found a way for them to be renewed like a child, to be restored. Elihu is speaking prophetically because who is this person? Elihu thinks it's an angel. It's not an angel. We know from our point in history, he's not describing an angel. He's describing Jesus Christ. Who else is a messenger, an advocate between you and God that gives you good advice, that can keep you from dying, and can actually rebirth you, restore, renew you like a child? Elihu's talking about a friend that sticks closer than a brother. There's a friend that sticks closer to your brother, closer to you than a brother. He's your advocate. You have the opportunity to pray as a friend of others. You have an opportunity to pray for your friends, and you have an opportunity to pray to your friend and for your friend Jesus Christ. How do you pray for your friend Jesus Christ who's advocating for you before God the Father? Well, you pray in thanksgiving. How else would you value your friends, your wingmen, the people you hang out with? Well, you thank them, spend more time with them, like being with them. Share your stories with them. Do things together. One friend sticks closer to you than a brother. It's Jesus Christ. That's what Elihu says. What will happen in all of this with good counsel, God beside you? What will happen in all of this? Well, he summarizes it. This is really exciting. With a friend that sticks closer than a brother, with godly advice coming from friends around you that we actually have as our vision in this church, to have faithful friends in fellowship, God will find favor with you. Yes, that you'll be that person that I mentioned at the beginning, and it's in their fullest expression. God will find favor with you, that He'll like you, that He'll be knocking on your door saying, hey, let's spend some time together today. Find favor with you, and He'll restore you to full well-being in this life and the next. And here's the zinger. You'll see God face to face. Some days I wake up and think, can this be the day? Because, yeah, life's pretty good here, but see your face? Why can't you take me and my family to be with you right now? That would be fantastic. Can you do that for me, God? No, you have more to do. Stay here. You get to see God face to face. That's incredible. It's exciting because this counseling that we have is a real mystery to me. It's a mystery to me that how we interact across these boundaries, that we can bless people with good advice, godly advice, that you are doing already. It's not something that it is a brand new thing that we're now going to do at Falling Brook Heights. We're going to now have good and godly counsel for each other. No, the only way this works is the fact that you've been doing it for years. How can we go from good to better to best advice from God? Let me wind up this way. I want to continue this conversation next week as well, too, but let me say this. When I was a financial planner, actually, when I was an investment advisor, we had a process through which we evaluated everybody that came in the door. And it was called Worth the Time. And in my head, as I listened to them tell me their financial story, I would determine whether they were worth the time. What was worth the time? Well, worth the time would be whether they had things like a decision-making capability, financial means, willingness, potential, whether they had money or the ability to invest. And most people passed my test, but some didn't, because it was about money and me making it. God does not have that test. Every human being is worth the time to Him. In fact, His whole creation is worth the time. His whole creation was worth the time for His Son to come, be born to a virgin, to live an impoverished life, sisters and brothers around Him in Nazareth, a nowhere place in Israel, to go through being minimized as a teacher for 3 years, and to give His life dying on a Roman cross, coming back from the dead, still being misunderstood by His disciples. That's how much it was worth the time for Him to save all of creation. And that's what Romans 8 tells us, is that's exactly what He did. Sometimes we doubt that because we don't see it happening in terms of how quickly we want it to happen, but He will redeem everything He's created. You're worth the time to Him. You're worth the time. You are exquisite and extraordinary. You're awesome and you're wonderful. There's no one like you. There's no one who can do what you do. You are profoundly important in the people that you know in terms of loving them. Your health as intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, socially is vitally important for what God's doing. And we have to support each other and care for each other that we are healthy together.